8. 100 days till test time. I have traveled across more than 20 countries all over the world, and not a single one of them has as big a gap as China. The gap is 100 years in economics, ideology, and concept. Zhou Nian Li, education professor at East China Normal University. When he isn't playing soccer or studying Chinese characters, Rainey likes to draw. At a small blue children's table underneath our dining room window, my little boy's touchstones materialize on paper. Birthday presents trussed up in bows, pork dumplings, sunfish caught in Minnesota lakes, Mao Zedong and the Tiananmen Square police. One afternoon, Rainey traced out a thick, single black line that took the shape of a flightless bird. "What's that, Rainey?" I asked.
"That's China,"
he said, assuredly, continuing to move his marker. "That's not a rooster?" I pressed.
"No, that's China,"
he said, continuing to draw. Rainey's China very much resembled a rooster. I watched carefully as my son's imagination emerged on sketch paper. This rooster is full-bodied with a chest puffed in conceit, a head and coxcomb that jut north into Russia, a curved back that cradles Mongolia, and imaginary feet that plant somewhere in the South China Sea. The capital city of Beijing sits on the eastern seaboard right at the throat of the cock, in prime position to exert a chokehold over the rest of the body. I tapped on this center of power absentmindedly.
"Where is Shanghai, Mom?"
Rainey asked.
"Right here.
We live right here," I said, as I traced my finger south along the coastline to find Shanghai situated at the crest of the rooster's proud, puffed-out chest. It was a fitting spot for China's trophy skyscraper city.
"Where is Ai from?"
Rainey asked, recalling that our nanny hopped the train during holidays to a faraway place to see family.
"Jiangsu province," I said, pointing my finger north of Shanghai, in the rooster's neck.
Almost in tandem, Rainey and I turned our gaze west over the body of the rooster, taking in the expanse of land that ran toward the borders of India, Pakistan, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, and Nepal.
"What's this here?"
Rainey asked, placing his palm flat on the page. "That's Western China, Rainey," I said, waving my entire hand over the body and tail of his rooster. Most foreign visitors travel only to the major cities concentrated in the east. As Rainey's finger crept toward Tibet in the middle of the Asian continent, I thought about the hundreds of millions of Chinese who live west of China's wealthy urbanized coast, in a mixture of large cities, smaller counties, and rural areas. What were their schools like? Did rural students feel academic pressure as the city folk did?
"Spend time outside Beijing and Shanghai," urged a fellow Stanford graduate who'd taught for 2 years in rural Guangdong province. "Visit rural China. The difference is night and day," other educators told me.
Another put it succinctly.
"Understand where China's school system came from, and you'll better understand where it's headed."
Conditions in rural schools could be dismal. It wasn't unheard of to find 130 kids jammed into a single classroom, a lack of potable water, and ill-trained teachers. Children were placed in boarding homes or schools while their parents toiled in faraway cities, with often illiterate grandparents left to help with homework. Others might be fortunate to share the same roof as their parents, but the average child's caretakers knew nothing of raising a child to excel in modern China.
"They knew more about raising a pig to slaughter than nourishing a child," read the report of one American research group.
When Shanghai's chart-topping students were announced to the world a few years ago, whispers about rural China intensified. "Those world number one PISA scores don't include rural areas," said critics who questioned the usefulness of the test. "Tally in students from poorer rural regions, the body and tail of the rooster, and China's average score would plummet like a bag of stones tossed into the Yangtze River," they insisted. One week, I stumbled upon some staggering numbers. Nearly half of all children outside of China's large cities are high school dropouts.
In rural areas, only about 7 of every 100 Chinese attend university of any kind. Children in cities are almost 12 times as likely to go to university. Income studies show a wealth gap between rich and poor China as large as the chasm between London and Bangladesh. As China's economy rocketed to the moon over the last few decades, it had left behind entire colonies of stragglers. How would the country continue to modernize and grow if hundreds of millions of poorly educated, impoverished Chinese languished in the countryside? I glanced down at Rainey's drawing. On his sketch paper, the distance between rural and urban China was only the width of a fingertip or two. In reality, that distance would make all the difference. I met Lauren in Shanghai in 2012. Lauren was a migrant from rural Anhui province just west of Shanghai, commonly called one of the poorest provinces in China. If we happened to see each other shortly after she'd gone home for a visit, she always brought me a shopper's plastic bag full of eggs, freshly laid orbs checkered with hen poop, which she urged me to steam and feed to my family. "It's good for eyesight," she'd tell me, head bobbing with enthusiasm. "Our countryside eggs are nutritious. See the bright orange in the yolk? I sat with this bag in my lap on the bus for 8 hours, and not a single egg broke." Lauren had wide shoulders and hips, broad feet made for patting down earth, and short thigh bones that helped maintain balance during squatting. Hers was a peasant's body, built for working the fields, but she'd left the countryside 20 years ago to chase big city money. After cycling through jobs in factories and restaurants, it finally dawned on her. The heft of a body built for the countryside would be great at delivering massages in the city. So she trained as a masseuse. For every hour she spent in dark bedrooms in Shanghai, she put 75 RMB, about $13, in her pocket. She moved silently, kneading backsides with agility and speed, and her hands rarely tired during the job. "My real name is Long Jiang," she told me when I first met her. "But a German client said Lauren would make me more approachable to foreigners." Lauren was a practical woman, and if a perfect stranger thought an Anglophone name would help her make money, she would take his suggestion. She'd always had that countryside practicality, and when she'd birthed her only child 15 years ago, she chose a utilitarian name for him, too. "Jun," or soldier, she told me. "Being a soldier is a good job. It's the Iron Rice Bowl. A stable government job. You get a pension." There's an unspoken Chinese rule about baby naming. It's perfectly fine, even encouraged, to choose a name that mirrors exactly what your heart desires. There's no need to disguise ambition, hope, or even greed. I've met many Chinese who have named their children after heady occupations, ambitions, government leaders, or even physical characteristics that society deems desirable. Big boss, tall, rich, beautiful. The latter, Mei, is a very popular given name for Chinese girls. Celebrities, pop stars, and entrepreneurs aren't off limits, nor are foreign luxury cars. I volunteer taught English classes for 2 years at a Shanghai kindergarten, and one of my favorite students was nicknamed Ferrari. "Why did your parents choose Ferrari?" I'd asked the 5-year-old boy one day.
"Because my mom said I'd own one someday," the boy responded.
Anglo naming rituals employ more restraint, with most given names having some kind of biblical or historical root. In other words, you must crack open the King James Bible or ponder Latin origins to get at a deeper meaning. Our son's Anglo names mean strong counselor and broad hill, but you'd never know it unless you went researching English and Germanic root forms. When it came time to give our sons Chinese names, I knew I'd have to quash my desire for subtlety. A long-held Chinese tradition grants naming responsibilities to the male elders of the family. And of all the trends I'd bucked, this one would be easy to follow. I asked my father to choose.
"I will start research immediately," he told me.
After consulting ancient texts, a Chinese dictionary, and a writer friend, my father announced,
"Rainey's Chinese name will be Lei."
pronounced Lei. It was the character for stone,
Shi,
written three times. Stone times three. It meant open and honest, and I was thrilled that he'd chosen a name with positive character traits that were unrelated to money or prosperity. For Rainey's little brother Landon, born 3 years later, my father got ambitious.
Xin, the character for gold. Jin, written three times,
he proclaimed.
It is pronounced Xin.
Gold times three.
It means profit and prosperity,
my father wrote me from his home in Houston. We feel weird naming our kid after wealth and fortune and prosperity, I wrote to my father from Shanghai, belly bulging as I entered my last weeks of pregnancy. Are you sure it's not obnoxious?
The character for gold alone is kind of obnoxious, but with three golds together, it's not. That's the amazing thing about the Chinese language,
he wrote back, diplomatically. Fine. Profit and prosperity it is, I said. Gold times three. Perhaps our son's given Chinese name would steer him into a higher earning profession than journalism or writing. For Lauren, her son's name served up a daily reminder of the goal she'd set for him. Joining the People's Liberation Army would spare the boy a lifetime of manual labor. Lauren has another hope. She wanted Junjun to be able to sleep in the same bed with his future wife. Because Lauren and Wang were migrant laborers, their jobs took them to different cities, linked only by mobile phone and long-distance bus or train. Lauren's singular mandate was that her son avoid the fate of his migrant worker parents. Neither had much of a formal education. Lauren's parents had sent her to the village schoolhouse 3 years late, and her educational decline was swift. The 8-year-old was simply too far behind to catch up. Before long, she found herself sitting behind the 5-year-olds in the room, the teacher's words gibberish to her ears. When the new term started the following fall, she simply stayed home. In his town, about a mile away, Wang fared 3 years better, finishing the 4th grade, but he dropped out after his family failed to come up with fees for meals, textbooks, and other incidentals. Lauren and her husband had met as teenagers working in Hangzhou, when they were both out from their villages. Wang was wiry and quick on his feet, and Lauren immediately sensed he'd put his restless energies toward work. When Lauren first brought her prospect home, her father proclaimed loudly,
"He has no money, no house, and no car,"
as Wang eyed the floor. True, yes, but Lauren refused to consider other men. After the wedding, the pair went back out again, she to a clothing factory and he to a construction site where he ate, worked, and slept. They met during holidays, and soon enough, Lauren gave birth to little Junjun. After a few months, Lauren left the boy with her parents and headed back out. Milk leaking through her shirt for days, she recalled. She'd made the right choice in Wang, Lauren told me. Wang doesn't pay for sex, a temptation that befalls many migrant men who see their wives only once a year. There was plenty else to celebrate. After 15 years working in separate cities, they'd saved enough money to build a 4-story home in the countryside, resplendent with tile finishings and a working refrigerator.
不错, not bad, Lauren always told me.
Economically and romantically, they were a success story in China's rural to urban migration, which increased the population of Chinese cities by roughly 400 million over the last 3 decades. When it came to Junjun's educational story, Lauren's fortunes shifted. In Shanghai, Lauren's massage business was thriving, but back in Anhui province, Junjun was struggling. China's antiquated household registration system, Hukou, kept Junjun from enrolling in public schools outside his home district. That meant that he couldn't join his mother to attend school wherever she migrated for work. For the first 15 years of his life, the boy lived with his grandparents while Lauren was out working. But for middle school, she moved him to a boarding home in nearby Jingxian County. It was a town of 350,000 with good schools and higher graduation rates. The teenager found himself suddenly surrounded by strangers. Conditions at the boarding home were something out of a Charles Dickens novel. The cook washed vegetables in a basin with her feet. Junjun slept 8 to a room, in bunk beds stacked 2 and 3 high to the ceiling, sharing one apartment with about 40 children. Lauren was paying the boarding mistress a fortune by Chinese standards, 4,900 RMB, $800 a semester. But Junjun was constantly hungry and didn't have enough water to drink. The glass had been punched out of the windows, leaving only vertical black bars. There was little light by which to read or study, and other teens kept him awake by talking late into the night. Exhausted without a good night's sleep, Junjun had begun falling asleep during class. Lauren could pay for his educational needs: food, books, tuition for private or experimental schools, outside tutoring, teacher gifts. But what Junjun really needed was a hug from a family member and real adult supervision.
"He's become a Liu Shou Artong, a left-behind child," Lauren moaned.
At the time, a fifth of China's children, 60 million kids under the age of 18, lived with one or no parents, casualties of China's push to move working-age rural Chinese into big cities. Like any child without the discipline a watchful parent provides, Junjun had become addicted to video games. He cared nothing of study, and he was depressed. The National High School Entrance Exam was just a year away. This Zhongkao would determine whether Junjun would go on to a traditional high school, with the eventual hope of going on to a proper college. For most Chinese, this exam is of far greater importance than the college test, and it determined whether a family might join the ranks of the emergent middle class.
"Junjun must get into high school. He must go to college," Lauren kept repeating.
The image of Junjun as a migrant worker, her worst nightmare. One day, Lauren got into a fight via text messages with the headmistress. Junjun had suffered a particularly bad showing on a test.
"My son's grades have fallen by half since I placed him in your home,"
Lauren had messaged to her son's boarding mistress, Zhang, who had promised free tutoring that never materialized.
"I hope you will take responsibility for him just like you do the other children."
"How can you send me a message like that?" headmistress Zhang spat back. "You have no education, and you have no suzhi, quality."
This was the ultimate insult to an uneducated migrant.
"You are right. I have no education, but I do have quality,"
Lauren spat back, tapping out a message as quickly as her thumbs could move.
"A mother like you, no wonder your son is the way he is. All the other parents take me out to eat. They express their appreciation. You don't,"
Zhang wrote.
"I'm paying you to take care of my child. How can you talk to me like this?"
Lauren retorted. But Zhang didn't respond, finding a more certain target the next day. Junjun. The headmistress slapped the boy across the face, jeering,
"Your mother doesn't love you."
Lauren was in Shanghai when her son relayed what had happened, and she became frantic. Junjun was in this woman's care, and Lauren was 6 to 9 hours away by long-distance bus.
"Junjun must be broken-hearted," she told me, fretting over what to do next. "He might start to believe we really don't love him. After all, we left him there, didn't we?"
she said. Lauren considered filing a grievance, but Zhang's operation was illegal and no authority would act on her complaint. Junjun was approaching his last year of compulsory education, and the National High School Entrance Exam sat sentry at the end of that road. His grades were slipping, along with the dreams Lauren and her husband had long held for him. It was time to go home. Lauren invited me to visit her in the countryside that spring. Since she'd left Shanghai a year earlier, I'd received a trickle of text messages that indicated a family trying to build a new life together, after a decade and a half apart. "We rented an apartment. The floor is unfinished, but it's close to school.
Junjun hates study. I don't know how to help him."
China had developed the high-speed rail and built the world's longest subway system in just over a decade. But the best way to get to Jingxian County was still a long-distance bus. One of those crawling, diesel-powered carriages that were a throwback to simpler times. I stepped up three giant, knee-high steps. My fellow passengers were dozens of migrants headed back home, and they munched on nuts and crackers, making popping noises with their teeth, tossing refuse in blue plastic bins that dotted the aisle. They coughed up phlegm with hacking, guttural noises and spat it in the aisle. My game of bladder hold began. There wouldn't be a pit stop for 2 hours, and even then, relieving yourself required squatting over long troughs of running water at a rural rest stop alongside other travelers, pants around ankles.
"The roads are good,"
the driver announced in Mandarin tinged with a rural accent.
"So today should be only a 7-hour journey."
As we exited the sleek, elevated expressways of China's trophy megacity, the skies grayed and the buildings shrank. 10-lane highways became 2-lane roads that sagged with dirt and potholes, with patches that were hastily poured. Our bus passed crews working alongside the road, clearing lots for shiny new buildings. The lots started right at the edge of the highway, and past that there was nothing as far as I could see. The tableau that unfolded outside the window was one of unblinking, rapid transformation, as fallow land disappeared under the crank of yellow-orange excavators. From my seat on the bus, I was witnessing the ambition of countryside that wanted desperately to be city. Billboards erected along the way hovered over giant mounds of unearthed, russet-colored dirt, advertising progress through slogans. "Buy a solar heating machine. A trusty bank is a money tree for generations. Build a civilized society and promote leaping developments." Building leaping developments was a dirty affair. And for much of the journey to Jingxian, construction dust hung in the air, clouding the sky and settling on the trees, shrouding their green leaves in a fine brown layer of silt. Looking out the window made me thirsty. The National High School entrance exam was just 3 months away. A full year had passed since Lauren's text message fight with Junjun's boarding headmistress. After 15 years living apart in 3 separate cities, the entire family was back under the same roof. Father, mother, son. I fell asleep, my head jammed against a tall picture window, thoughts bouncing around as jarringly as the bus on the pitted road. Junjun grew up with little supervision, and suddenly his parents slept in the bed next to him. How was the teenager adjusting? What were his prospects on the Zhongkao? Lauren and her husband were uneducated. How could they expect to help Junjun in math and physics? Hours later, my bus rolled into Jingxian Station, and I spotted Lauren through the dust-covered windows. She was standing before a navy blue Baojun sedan, a Chinese car. I disembarked, blinking in the sunlight, and Wang strode over to me.
"It's a Chinese car, but it has a foreign engine."
Wang made sure to tell me, ushering me into his vehicle. Even in the dusty corners of China, imports carried status, while domestic brands were something to explain away. Lauren filed in beside me in the back seat.
"Wang will drive us to my massage parlor," she said.
"You own a massage parlor?" I exclaimed. Lauren nodded, glancing at me sideways. Massage parlors were notorious as fronts for prostitution. I doubted she was turning tricks, but it wasn't a good sign she'd leaped headfirst into a business full of competitors who played dirty.
"Business is slow," she said,
explaining that she'd emptied several years' worth of savings, the equivalent of about $10,000, into buying the venture. We passed shells of buildings in various stages of construction. Structures of steel and concrete gaped with black holes where windows were to be installed. Cranes dotted the sky. It felt as if we were driving through a Legoland set. The county government wanted to double the population, drawing from the peasant poor of the surrounding countryside. For officials here, as everywhere in China, promotions were earned based on GDP, gross domestic product, growth. which meant that the mantra for development often was, build it and hope they come.
Jingxian government has big plans, Lauren said. The county was a talc exporter until recently, when the local government discerned that setting up processing plants would keep more money in the region. The average annual income of its residents was the equivalent of a few thousand dollars a year. Enough to kick it off China's list of poor counties a few years ago. It was a typical regional center in China, and there was nothing noteworthy about it, just as there was nothing unusual about Lauren's story. There were hundreds of Jingxian counties in China, struggling to sustain a healthy pace of development, and millions of rural Chinese just like Lauren, working to educate their only child. I pondered the empty buildings, vacant sidewalks, and newly poured roads. Besides our Baojun, there were few cars on the road. The people hadn't come yet.
We're just a few months away from Zhongkao, Lauren said, handing me a newspaper from Junjun's school.
Printed in red and black on 6 pages of broadsheet, the paper was teeming with references to student rankings, loyalty to country and party, and the upcoming Zhongkao.
Zhongkao is 100 days away, proclaimed the article at the top of the page,
teeming with phrases that seemed like a call to war.
We cannot waste a single minute or second in our dash to the goal. The opportunity to prove ourselves is here. We need to work very hard these 100 days in order to repay our parents, repay our teachers, repay the school, and give ourselves a better future.
On the second page, there was a list of top scorers on the school-wide final exam.
Here we post their names in praise, the paper read, listing 93 names divided by grade level.
A student essay about humility promoted collective learning.
My friend ran very fast during the 1,000-meter run. I had a model to follow. Always find someone better to motivate yourself.
Then, a piece about duty to country.
We need to take responsibility for ourselves, our friends, our country, and society. We have duties to fulfill.
The paper was chock full of propaganda, cobbled together to create both a sense of urgency and a feeling that scoring well was a student's duty to community and country.
How is little June doing? I asked Lauren, who sighed. He's abandoned hope, Fang Qi, a little bit. We push him to study, but he doesn't care anymore.
Well, he still has time. 100 days, to be exact, I said, patting the newspaper.
It's too late. He's very tired, Lauren said. He says he prefers America's education system. From kindergarten up until high school, the parents don't have to manage the children. And the knowledge they learn is useful rather than something you learn only for a test.
Where did he hear about America? I asked.
Movies, television. He said that the American kids always seem so happy.
A headmaster's speech had been printed on the last page of the school paper, word for word. We, the leaders, want you to fulfill your dreams, and our dreams. Zhongkao is very important, and it will decide your fate and your future. Now is the critical moment. Diligence is the only way to fulfill your goal. We arrived at Lauren's massage parlor, where diligence was nowhere to be seen. Junjun sat behind the front desk, engaged in rapid-fire clicking. He was playing League of Legends, a multiplayer battle game involving marauding bandits, monsters, and guns.
I don't know how to help Junjun, Lauren told me.
I glanced at her. I wanted to suggest that Junjun bend his head over a math textbook rather than digital monsters, but I kept quiet.
I've been too busy managing the massage parlor, Lauren said.
I looked around. Not a customer in sight, only a heap of candy-colored 6-inch-high pumps. Lauren selected a pair, stepping out of her street shoes and into a pair of green and white heels. Their situation was turning out to be more challenging than I'd thought. Lauren was illiterate and couldn't help with the boys' study. The family's relationship with the boys' boarding mistress, who was supposed to help with test prep, had been severed. They'd depleted their savings to buy this business along with a Baojun with a foreign engine, and they had little money for tutors. After she'd bought the business, Lauren discovered that the previous owner had been selling sex out of the upstairs rooms. Lauren refused to qiao da bei, or knock big back. So the parlor's regulars stopped coming around, and Lauren's masseuses fled for a rival as business dwindled. Lauren and Wang had arrived back in the countryside, 15 years too late, to oversee the studies of a boy they'd lost long ago. The odds are loaded against rural children in China. The prospects of a student like Junjun are leagues behind that of a Darcy or an Amanda, who attend good high schools in urban centers with resources and access to teacher talent. Fang Qi, giving up hope, would almost certainly be part of Junjun's future. This makes the boy one face of an inequality index that development experts call an urban-rural gap in health, wealth, and education of more than 100 years. I have traveled across more than 20 countries all over the world, and not a single one of them has as big a gap as China, says education professor Zhou Nianli. As incomes were skyrocketing in major urban centers such as Shanghai, fueling the staggering media headlines about China's economic juggernaut over the last few decades, the inequality index in China rose more than that of any country in the world. China's economic roller coaster had left many families without a ticket, watching from outside the amusement park. Many of those households are in rural China. Their children face a litany of problems, starting from inside the womb. A research team out of Stanford University surveyed 350 villages and found that more than half of the babies they tested were malnourished. 80%, if they included children who were borderline anemic. 3 out of 4 showed delayed cognitive skills. Parents who must migrate for work might be absent for years, like Lauren was, forced to leave kids with grandparents even less educated than they are. By middle school, the researchers found, almost half of rural Chinese children have an IQ lower than 90. Average. All of this is overlaid with a system that is fast-tracking only the 20 to 25% of kids who will actually go on to high school.
The teachers ignore the rest of them,
says Scott Rizal of Stanford University's Rural Education Action Program. Without the financial, emotional, or academic support to stay in school, these kids fall behind. They're one entrance exam failure away from dropping out of school, and drop out of the system they do. At astonishing rates. Many teenagers go out to work immediately doing unskilled labor. But those jobs are increasingly moving to lower-wage countries such as Vietnam, Bangladesh, and Indonesia. Others languish at home, the welfare recipients of parents who send money home from faraway cities. Some might enter vocational high schools of varying quality. This fate of uncertainty befalls too many rural Chinese children. When these kids become working-age adults within a couple of decades, they'll be among hundreds of millions of Chinese who won't have the skills to fully participate in a high-wage, innovation-based economy, estimate the experts. That's roughly a third of the population. And, as Rizal says,
China still isn't rich enough to support a welfare state. So the stage is set for massive unrest, organized and unorganized crime, gang activities, and more.
So here was a reason China didn't allow rural provinces to count in the first 2 rounds of PISA scores released to the world. There simply wouldn't be much to boast about. In the most recent round, in 2015, indeed China slipped after Beijing and 2 other provinces were included with Shanghai's results. I met Little Bai and Little Tong deep in Henan province. I was traveling with a volunteer organization that focused on migrant and rural education, and during a free morning, I found these girls slurping down breakfast on a street corner teeming with vendors. We were in Luyi County, hours from Shanghai by train then bus, due northwest of Shanghai. On Rainey's map of China, I'd be inside the rooster's chest, around where its wing might originate.
You don't drink soup?
Little Bai asked me. Hunan was one of the poorest, most densely populated provinces in China, with an average of 1,464 people packed into every square mile. Little Bai, a slender girl poured into jeans despite the heat, sat on a low stool before a metal vat of glutinous maroon-colored broth. The soup sold for 3 kuai a bowl, or about 40 cents. The soup emitted slow, lazy bubbles with the consistency of boiling paste. A weathered vendor hovered over the vat, and the entire affair was situated a few paces from a bustling street choked with scooters, vehicles, and exhaust. No, I said, after considering this question. I don't drink soup.
I eat this every day, Little Bai said, bending over her red paste. So I won't be thirsty.
The girls were 16 and 17, and neither had seen her family in months. Little Tong's parents were nomadic shepherds working in Xinjiang, and Little Bai's parents ran a pharmacy in another town. Their parents had dropped them off in this dusty nowhere town at a middle school where they could eat, sleep, and study in the same building. For these girls, the National High School Entrance Exam was 18 days away.
Come back to the classroom with us, Little Tong said, slipping her hand into mine as we walked down a long stretch of street.
We passed a tree that earlier that day had provided shade for a man in a blue jumpsuit, pleasuring himself during a break from work.
Oh, I'd uttered as I spotted him, and his eyes met mine, expressionless. I'd hurried past the man as his hand continued to pump below the waist. He was the poster boy for a migrant laborer separated from his family by long, isolated work weeks on a construction site. This town was all ambition and no heart, with empty buildings in various stages of construction and few inhabitants save the building workers and the students.
The school is very decrepit, Little Bai said cheerily as we approached a coral-colored four-story building, set back from the street and enclosed by a 10-foot-high steel gate.
We climbed the stairs to a second-floor classroom encased in dull white plaster. Newspapers dating back 2 years papered over a row of high windows, letting in only a hint of the sun outside.
She's an American teacher visiting from Shanghai, Little Bai told her classmates, who sat at desks arranged in four rows.
Each desk was covered with books placed upright, forming a barricade between teacher and student that conjured up a great wall of books.
I'm the fat one,
announced a plump teenager, cackling at her own candor.
I'm the tall one,
proclaimed a thin girl sitting in the second row.
And I'm the stupid one,
Little Tong chimed in, to more laughter.
Who's the best student in the class? I asked.
I was always intrigued when I posed this question to a classroom, as everyone always knew the answer. 10 hands pointed to a skinny girl in black eyeglasses sitting in the front row.
And where are you?
I asked the fat girl, who wore dark sunglasses despite the already dim classroom. Fat girl lowered her hand to the ground, as if she were stabbing at the void beneath the bottom rung of a ladder.
I'm here. Low, low, low.
I slipped into a seat between Fat Girl and Little Tong in the third row, and a stern-looking woman sauntered into the room. The class suddenly quieted. The teacher immediately launched into her lesson.
Let's turn to question 18, the woman said. A truck transported some goods from place A to place B. X is the time, and Y is the distance from the truck to A. Use the information in the graph to solve the questions below.
As heads dropped over desks in the front row, I focused on faces and body language, and quickly discerned that the classroom was arranged according to aptitude and ambition. Students in the front row were pert and alert, captained by the number one student, but performance and attentiveness leveled off as you moved to the back of the room. In the second row, Fat Girl didn't even pretend to be interested in solving distances. She was busy whittling down the fingernail on her pointer finger with a pair of scissors, shearing it into a collection of planes and ridges. Two girls in row three took turns massaging each other's thighs.
Now, write the functional expression between X and Y during the truck's return to A,
the teacher said, seemingly to no one. In the back row, three boys played video games on their mobile phones, hidden behind their great wall of books. It was a long, slow day in June, and the heat and light reverberated in the room as the teacher droned on. To me, it was clear. School was a joke to most of these students, since many were just passing time. It was 18 days until Zhongkao, and instead of a sense of urgency, I found complacency and acceptance. For years, they'd taken practice tests, and few students would be surprised by the outcome. I whispered to little Tong, the daughter of nomads, who was smacking gum, "Show me your monthly test papers." She collected heaps of papers from her desk and crumpled them in her right fist. "Here, take them," she said, thrusting them before me. "I have no use for them." I uncrinkled one. It was a physics test, and she'd scored 4 out of 50 possible points. I flattened the others, and they were no better. 8 of 80 points in algebra. In chemistry, she'd scribbled a few characters underneath the first question, but the rest of the paper was blank. She grabbed the wad of papers and shoved them into my bag. "Take them with you. Look at them later," little Tong whispered. A stick of gum made its way to me from row 4.
"This is from America,"
little Tong whispered, as I glanced at the stick of Wrigley spearmint gum. The wrapper displayed a monkey balancing an assortment of tropical fruits. "What do you want to do when you grow up?" I whispered to the girls in my row. Fat girl had propped a mirror against her books and was checking her face, head lowered to escape detection.
"I want to sell fabrics," she said. "I want to put together buyers and sellers."
"I want to be a nurse," said little Bai. "I want to manage a hotel," whispered little Tong.
Over their voices, the teacher said, flatly, "Now let's first look at the graph of this function. What does the x-axis mean?" In the third row, one girl picked wax out of her neighbor's ear with the pointy tip of a pencil. The kids had few adult role models, and teachers had become paramount to their development. Yet the teachers were often migrants for hire themselves, shuttling in and out of classrooms, with little connection to the students in their charge. After another half hour, class was over, and the teacher scooted from the room. "Where's the teacher from?" I asked, directing my question at row 2.
"She's from Shangqiu,"
fat girl said, naming a larger town an hour-long train ride away.
"She's only been here for a few months. They never stay long."
"Why not?" I asked. The teacher hadn't acknowledged the presence of a stranger in her classroom, much less inquired why I was there. And now I understood why. Her connection to these children and investment in their future were little more than a paycheck.
"Because we're stupid,"
chimed in a boy from the back row, finally lifting his head from his mobile phone.
"We only have 18 more days of school anyways," said fat girl. 18 more days, then no more school ever."
"Won't you take the Zhongkao?" I asked her.
"Yes, but I will fail."
"Then it's no more school."
Months later, back home in Shanghai, I would glance at a snapshot I'd taken of little Bai and little Tong on my last day with them. The daughter of pharmacists and the daughter of nomads stand arm in arm before a long stretch of empty, unpaved dirt road, flanked by shells of buildings. For a year, they'd lived, slept, and studied side by side. But after the Zhongkao, their futures would diverge sharply. Little Tong, the daughter of nomads, scored a 291 out of 600 points. It was a dismal result, and her parents had no money for alternatives. Tong's family wouldn't be able to buy the several hundred points needed to go on to high school, bribe a principal, or pay a middleman a school introduction fee. In rural areas, you could find back doors into academic high schools, but you still needed to score above a certain threshold. Otherwise, that workaround would be largely out of reach. Little Tong would go straight to work. Little Bai, the daughter of a pharmacist, scored much higher, 430.
still 70 points shy of the cutoff to go to an academic high school that year. The score was close enough to pave the way for entrance. Her parents had money, and they were willing to spend. Such backdoors only served to widen the inequality gap. Those families with money have options that are life-changing for their children. My snapshot was eerily prescient. Little Tong stood thin and lean with her heart-shaped face, crinkled under the sun, her eyes closed when the shutter had snapped. Little Bai gazed into the camera, head high and smile confident, left hand up in a victory sign. 2 years later, I would check in with Little Bai, now mired in study at an academic high school. By that time, her former classmate Little Tong had cycled through as many low-wage jobs as there were years in her life, before finally heading to Xinjiang to join her shepherd parents. Almost 3 years after she failed Zhongkao, Little Tong would send me pictures of her heavily pancaked, thickly rouged face, set against the bright light of the massage parlor where she worked. I wondered whether she felt pressure to turn tricks, and I felt sad about her state of affairs. Little Bai, knee-deep in books, was confident she'd test into university, but she sobered whenever I asked about her old friend. If a WeChat message could issue a sigh, hers would. Oh, Little Tong, life is unfair. Society is cruel. I came back from these rural provinces with a firm understanding. It wouldn't be much of a reach to say that Rainey is part of a giant education experiment. Consider that just 6 decades ago, 4 of every 5 Chinese couldn't read. The year was 1949, and Mao Zedong and his armies marched against the educated elite and the moneyed, including families like my maternal grandfather's, who owned the central bank in the town of Shanhaiguan. It was an inconvenient time to be wealthy and literate, and Mao and his communists chased the ruling Kuomintang out of China and across the straits into Taiwan. With Mao at its helm, the People's Republic of China was established, and its new leaders quickly got to work. The Communist Party drafted a constitution based on the Soviet model and set about seizing Kuomintang schools and starting new ones in the name of state building. Mao's education officials could only start from scratch. Textbooks, teaching methods, basic goals. Qualified teachers had to be hired. A primary school curriculum developed. From there, the system evolved throughout a number of his campaigns. Mao's industrialization efforts during the 4-year Great Leap Forward starting in 1958 tied education to labor and production goals, while the ensuing Cultural Revolution's halt of formal education saw books burned, teachers humiliated, and a complete halt to college admissions during the 10-year period starting 1966. Since the 1980s, the Chinese government sought to modernize schools and enroll most children in 9 years of free compulsory schooling, an era that gave rise to the quality education reforms. Leaders have also worked to develop a citizenry strong in science and technology, and those goals too were disseminated through the education system. New objectives have been inked in recent years, such as the hope of enrolling all children in preschool and ensuring that 9 of every 10 Chinese attends senior high school. My dream is to ensure that we can teach students in accordance with their aptitudes, provide education for all people without discrimination, and cultivate every person in this nation to become a talent, said Education Minister Yuan Guiren in 2013. As I absorbed the history of modern education in China, I grew dizzy from the flips and turns. Take the attitude toward educated intellectuals. Depending on the decade, they were alternately praised and emulated, reviled, banished, or killed, depending on their views. Education in China has always been characterized by bold moves, major shifts, and reversals, as the researcher Mun Zhang wrote. Still, there was no mistaking how much progress the country had made in 6 decades. Putonghua, the Mandarin most educated Chinese speak today, was only adopted as the national dialect in 1956. More than a few researchers have dubbed the party's efforts to eradicate illiteracy perhaps the single greatest educational effort in human history. In the following decades, the Chinese government established a school system that educates a fifth of the world's population. And with basic literacy and compulsory education established, the government would continue to refine its goals. Change would begin in cities such as Shanghai, where funding and connections and the openness of city folk mix and mingle in a laboratory of sorts. Schools that lacked access or the right confluence of circumstances, unfortunately, would lag. There isn't enough money for everything all at once, said Wang Feng, my Ministry of Education source. We're not a developed country whose wealth is sufficient to finance every school toward the right track of development. So our resources are distributed first to develop some schools, while the other schools carry out the duty of reducing illiteracy. This generates a gap between good schools and bad ones. Stanford researcher Scott Rizal laments that education in modern China suffers as Beijing focuses attention elsewhere. Divert a mere ounce of the money that China devotes to sending a man to the moon, building a Xi'an to Urumqi high-speed rail, or giving to Africa, he says, and it would change the face of rural China. It is not about having enough money. It is about priorities. Whatever the case, progress is not evenly distributed. The quality of Little Tong and Little Bai's education was only as good as the teachers who cycled in and out of their classrooms. And in rural areas, the teachers changed stations as frequently as the trains at the nearest depot. As the government encouraged migration to urban centers, rural schools were also consolidating and enrollment was dropping. Junjun's school in Anhui province, and even Little Pumpkin's school in Shanghai, notched far below Rainey's on the educational quality totem pole. Going to school in Shanghai offered a student other advantages. The city was also a province, making Shanghai a special education zone with the autonomy to write its own curriculum and launch special initiatives. For every child privileged enough to wrestle his or her way through schools in Shanghai, there were a handful of children in the countryside who were struggling without proper support in poorly resourced schools or had been left to fend for themselves educationally as their parents toiled in another city. These factors would combine to form a stubborn inequality that would continue to be a drag on the system. As long as the Junjuns existed, the educational triumphs of teenagers like Amanda would come with a bittersweet footnote. That note might read something like the words of Suzanne Pepper, who wrote that education can be a great destabilizer, given its capacity to raise aspirations faster than developing political institutions could satisfy them. There would never be true progress as long as rural education continued to struggle. Outside Junjun's bedroom window lay his first job opportunity.
A construction site. If you fail Zhongkao, you can go straight to work,
his father teased his son. Junjun snorted from his desk, piled high with books, pausing to ponder his view of workers who transported earth between gaping holes and tall piles all day long. I'd come back to see Junjun and his family the week before Zhongkao. His father, Wang, collected me up from the long-distance bus station in his Baojun with the foreign engine and drove me to their rented apartment. The floors were unfinished, doors still wrapped in blue manufacturer's plastic. In Junjun's bedroom, the three of us were close enough to smell each other's breath.
This will be on the Zhongkao,
Junjun muttered as Wang settled into a plastic chair near his desk. I sat on the bed, where I could see the boy's hunched back.
This will be on Zhongkao, too. This will not, so I won't need to study this.
The boy stooped over his physics book, flipping pages, pencils scratching on paper, following by long periods of silence. He seemed distressed, and he muttered to his father in their Anhui dialect. What's the matter? I asked Wang in Mandarin. Wang's foot tapped the concrete floor.
He doesn't understand any of this homework,
Wang whispered. I stood up and spotted a math test on the desk. He'd received 102 out of 150 points. That's not bad, I muttered encouragingly to Wang.
It's not enough to pass Zhongkao,
Wang said.
I can't even write out this equation,
Junjun said, swigging from a glass jug of green tea. The tea leaves drifted in the beige-yellow liquid. Aimless.
Junjun was now working on a calculus problem set involving derivative proofs. China's curriculum was famously difficult, and content in heavily populated provinces such as Anhui was particularly advanced, so that it could effectively weed out large numbers of students.
Keep trying, Wang urged Junjun.
Do you sit here every night? I whispered to Wang.
Yes. I don't understand any of the papers, but I like to make sure he writes something on every page,
Wang said, lowering his head.
His education level is much higher than mine.
Junjun could read and speak some English. He was testing well on advanced math, and he was already touching upon calculus. He'd already attained what any Westerner would consider a high level of education for a 16-year-old. But in rural China, this wasn't always enough to get into an academic high school. What will he do next year if he doesn't pass Zhongkao?
I don't know.
Wang sighed.
He's so young. I don't know.
But Wang knew, even if he wouldn't say. The construction worker wasn't good with books, but he was wise in the ways of modern China, and he knew Junjun would eventually follow the same path his father had 20 years earlier, out to the factories and building sites. Though, I wondered, as China's economy slowed and its manufacturing base inched over to other parts of Asia, whether Junjun would be able to find work as easily as his father always had. It was 9 p.m. on a school night. Their son was on his last stop in China's 9 years of compulsory education. The family had staked its entire working life on financing him, with textbooks, test prep, tutoring, and boarding homes, through to the next rung of education. But it appeared Junjun was about to fall off the ladder. Lauren and Wang tried to make up for 15 years of missed parenting, but Zhongkao was marching toward them full steam. Lauren remembers journeying home at Chinese New Year to visit her little third grader. Her prescient 9-year-old revealed a hatred not only for his name but for the path that it signified.
Junjun, soldier, that's a stupid name,
the boy had said.
Who wants to be a soldier anymore?